The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love from the North Carolina Reading Service, and I am the host and producer for today's episode of Health Issues. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Harvard Health Letter. Our first story is about blood pressure and how you can take back control of your blood pressure. Many factors can sabotage your efforts to control high blood pressure. You might have an underlying condition, such as sleep apnea, that contributes to the problem, or you might be taking medication, such as a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drug, or NSAID, that interferes with your blood pressure medicine. But often the main culprit that keeps blood pressure high despite treatment is lifestyle. So it's time to regain control of your blood pressure by examining key areas that you can likely improve on your own. Here are five to start with, as recommended by Dr. Stephen Jurashek, a blood pressure specialist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. The first is diet. Diet is a common saboteur of blood pressure treatment. For example, if you eat too much salt or sodium, the body retains fluids. Increased fluid inside blood vessels raises the pressure in them. Sodium negates some of our best first-line treatments of high blood pressure, such as diuretics, which promote fluid excretion, Dr. Jurashek says. Potassium also plays a role in high blood pressure. If you're not consuming enough of this mineral, you don't reap its benefit of helping the body remove sodium. And eating a lot of saturated fat can lead to high cholesterol and plaque buildup in the arteries, which can narrow and stiffen them, contributing to high blood pressure. Here's what you can do. For stubborn high blood pressure, Dr. Jurashek advises limiting sodium to 1,500 milligrams per day and following the dietary approaches to stop hypertension or DASH diet, which is rich in fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, beans, nuts, seeds, and vegetable oils. He also urges you to read food labels, even for foods that seem healthy, like whole grain breads, low-fat dairy products, and fresh poultry. Sodium is in most foods in the grocery store, and the levels can be stunning. I found one salad dressing with a third of the daily salt allowance in just 2 tablespoons, says Dr. Jurashek. And try to increase your potassium intake. While it can be difficult to reach the recommended daily amount, which is 4,700 milligrams, it's still worth eating more potassium-rich foods. Fruits, particularly bananas, oranges, and avocados, leafy greens, and legumes. Also, replacing table salt with a potassium-enriched salt substitute can help. And then there's weight. Being overweight keeps blood pressure high in numerous ways. For example, extra pounds trigger inflammation, which harms blood vessels, as well as the release of hormones that impair blood pressure regulation. Here's what you can do. Commit to losing weight if you need to. A panel of experts concluded that for every 22 pounds a person loses, he or she may be able to reduce systolic blood pressure, the top number in the measurement, by 5 to 20 millimeters of mercury. Enough to make a real difference when you're aiming for blood pressure less than 130 over 80. Weight loss strategies include eating a healthy diet, reducing calorie intake, exercising, getting enough sleep, such as 7 to 9 hours a night, and managing stress. For someone with obesity, Dr. Jurashek says he might prescribe a GLP-1 receptor agonist, such as semaglutide or Wegovy, liraglutide, Saxenda, or tirzepatide, Zepbound. It helps reduce body mass and circulating cholesterol, and it's related to reduction of 3 to 4 points in systolic blood pressure, he says. The next area of improvement could be alcohol intake. Alcohol is often responsible for high blood pressure that won't come down. That's because heavy, long-term consumption of alcohol can increase body chemicals that make you hold on to water and that keep your blood vessels from relaxing normally. Both effects contribute to high blood pressure. Here's what you can do. Dr. Jurashek says you don't need to stop drinking alcohol altogether if your high blood pressure isn't coming down. But he does advise patients, both men and women, to limit their alcohol intake to no more than one drink per day. Then, of course, there's physical activity. A sedentary lifestyle leads to stiff arteries and impaired blood vessel function, which are major causes of high blood pressure. Exercise helps reverse that. Both strength training and aerobic activity, the kind that gives your heart and lungs a workout, trigger the production of nitric oxide, a molecule that relaxes and widens blood vessels. Both types of exercise also strengthen the heart, helping it pump blood more efficiently, which reduces the strain on your blood vessels. What you can do? Try to strengthen your muscles twice a week, perhaps using resistance bands or doing body weight exercises at home, or using the weight machines at a gym. And aim for 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity aerobic exercise, such as brisk walking, water aerobics, or riding a stationary bike. If you haven't exercised in a long time, make sure it's okay with your doctor first. Then, start with 5 minutes of exercise per day, gradually increasing the amount over time. And lastly, you might look at your medication schedule. The late U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop famously said that drugs won't work if you don't take them. That's often the reason why someone's blood pressure remains high. Poor medication adherence can be due to many reasons, such as costs, side effects, inconvenient dosing schedules, complicated drug regimens, forgetfulness, or simply not believing the medications will help, Dr. Jurashek says. Unfortunately, people who don't take their blood pressure pills are more likely to die prematurely. So here's what you can do. If you have a complicated medication regimen, or you need reminders to take your pills, use tools like an automatic pill dispenser, a medication diary, a smartphone alarm, or a reminder app. Popular ones include MyTherapy and MediSave. If you're concerned about medication side effects or costs, reach out to your doctor. It may be possible to switch to another drug. The five aspects of lifestyle we've listed are just part of the equation to help tame high blood pressure. Other areas are also important. If you smoke, you'll need to quit. And if you have poor sleep, high stress, or high caffeine intake, you'll need to work on those too. It's always going to be important to modify your lifestyle regardless of whether you're taking medications to get your blood pressure down, Dr. Jurashek says. If you don't make lifestyle changes, your health and your blood pressure will likely get worse. This next article asks whether you should take pills or use patches for pain relief and talks about the differences between those. Let's start by some definitions. What are some common pain patches? You're probably familiar with common pain pills such as aspirin, acetaminophen or Tylenol, and ibuprofen or Advil. But do you know your options for pain relief patches? Here are some common types. One is menthol, 4% lidocaine, or capsaicin patches, sold over-the-counter and are typically used for muscle soreness or mild joint pain. Another type is 5% lidocaine patches. Those are available by prescription for localized pain, such as minor injuries or long-lasting nerve pain from shingles. We all want effective pain remedies, and pills and patches are common options. Both are available with prescription or non-prescription active ingredients. But which is best to relieve discomfort, a pill or a patch? How they work. Pain pills and pain patches deliver medication in different ways. When you take a pain pill, its active ingredients are absorbed through the gastrointestinal tract, broken down in the liver, and sent to the bloodstream for quick distribution throughout the body. Patches are placed on the skin. The active ingredients work locally, and they are absorbed into the bloodstream more slowly and to a lesser degree than the active ingredients in pain pills. Pain pills and patches have their own sets of potential problems. For example, pain pills might be hard to swallow for some people, might not be absorbed well due to digestive health or diet issues, might interact with another drug being processed in the liver, causing dangerously high or low levels of either drug, might cause gastrointestinal side effects such as nausea, ulcers, or stomach bleeding, depending on the drug. In contrast, pain patches are slower to start working, which isn't ideal for sudden or immediate acute pain. Might cause skin irritation at the site where you apply it, and might not be available with the active ingredient you need. The benefits are some pain pills and patches have their own distinct benefits. For example, because pain patches work slowly, they provide a steady stream of medication over an extended period that can be helpful for chronic pain or long-term recovery from an injury. Patches are also convenient for people with swallowing difficulties or those who have a hard time remembering to take pills. And because patches are absorbed through the skin, you avoid the gastrointestinal side effects and potential interactions, said Dr. Sanjit Narang, a pain medication specialist and director of the Arnold Warfield Pain Center at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. In contrast, pain pills work quickly. That's important if you need rapid relief of your pain, like a sudden pounding headache or a backache from doing too much yard work. For rapid relief, an over-the-counter painkiller like acetaminophen, Tylenol, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen, Advil, or Motrin, is the best approach. Following surgery or for various chronic pain conditions, over-the-counter pills might not be enough. Prescription pills such as gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, or even opioids such as oxycodone, also known as OxyContin, may be required. Dr. Narang says that pills are typically preferred for acute pain requiring rapid relief, but both pills and patches work for chronic pain. The ones we prescribe or recommend depend on your needs, and in some cases, we'll advise patients to use a combination approach of both patches and pills, he said. Creams or ointments you rub on the skin are another option. Another important consideration is medication risk. For example, regular long-term use of NSAIDs can irritate the stomach lining and cause ulcers or stomach bleeding. Even short-term use of NSAIDs slightly increases the risk for heart attack and stroke. And opioids can be addicting and even life-threatening if you take too many. So talk to your doctor before trying something new, even if it's just an over-the-counter pain pill or patch you see in the drugstore. It might have a risk you don't know about. And if you ever experience sudden, extreme pain, such as the sudden onset of the worst headache of your life or sudden chest or abdominal pain, don't diagnose yourself. Call 911 or your doctor. And now here's an important article for people who suffer from restless leg syndrome. People with restless leg syndrome can't help it. They are racked with an extremely uncomfortable, overwhelming need to move their legs when resting, typically at night. It forces them to walk around for relief, which lasts only while they're moving. For more than 20 years, the go-to treatment for RLS has been a class of medications called dopamine agonists, such as pramipexole, also known as Mirapex, ropinirole, and transdermal rotigotine, also known as Neuropro. But the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, or AASM, now says that while the drugs may help at first, long-term use can eventually make RLS symptoms worse, so it recommends against such use. We no longer recommend them as a first-line treatment, and maybe not even the second. You have to warn patients about them and monitor them regularly if they take them, says Dr. John Winkleman, an RLS specialist and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He led the AASM task force that wrote the new recommendations, which were published in the January 2025 issue of the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine. Dopamine agonists mimic the effects of dopamine, a brain chemical that helps regulate movement. For people with RLS, whose brains might have difficulty using dopamine properly, the drugs temporarily restore dopamine function and alleviate symptoms. But the brain eventually gets used to dopamine agonists, diminishing their effectiveness over time and requiring higher doses for symptom relief. Even more concerning, this can lead to augmentation, a process in which RLS symptoms become more severe, widespread, extending to the arms, and frequent, occurring both at night and day. Over time, many people have to take the medications three times a day, and if they miss a single dose, their leg and arm symptoms are terrible. They can't drive, work, ride on a plane, or go to a movie. Anything where you can't get up and move around, Dr. Winkleman says. Dr. Winkleman says dopamine agonists are prescribed for two-thirds of the people who are treated for RLS. Among those people, a quarter to half of them have augmentation, and the rest are at risk for it, he says. The process doesn't occur immediately. It develops in about 8% of patients per year. Many people can go years before it develops. But given that people might develop RLS symptoms in middle age, you have a lot of years left for augmentation to occur, Dr. Winkleman says. Based on evidence from the last decade, the AASM's new RLS guidelines now strongly recommend another class of medications as the first line of treatment. The drugs, called alpha-2-delta ligands, help regulate the nervous system and reduce RLS symptoms without causing augmentation. Examples of alpha-2-delta ligands include gabapentin, also known as Neurontin, gabapentin and acarbol, known as Horizont, and pregabalin, also known as Lyrica. The new guidelines also recommend the use of intravenous or oral iron supplementation for people with low levels of iron in the brain, which is a potential cause for RLS. Anyone with blood iron levels in the bottom half of the normal range has an increased risk of low brain iron levels and may benefit from iron supplementation, Dr. Winkleman says. Switching to an alternative medication after being on a dopamine agonist requires careful supervision. You can't suddenly stop taking it. That brings on rebound symptoms with a vengeance. We have to detox you, adding another medication that will help symptoms, and then slowly tapering you off the dopamine agonist by 10% a month. It can take 6 months to a year, Dr. Winkleman says. If other medications fail to treat your symptoms, or if you can't tolerate them, the guidelines say it might be okay to take a dopamine agonist, but only with extreme caution. You must be monitored regularly and should switch to an alternative if augmentation starts, Dr. Winkleman says. Here's what else you can do. In addition to taking medications, a number of pill-free strategies can help reduce RLS symptoms. The basics include modest exercise and avoiding factors known to make RLS worse, such as alcohol, antihistamines, anti-nausea drugs, and most antidepressants. Other approaches can help too, such as treating obstructive sleep apnea, if you have it, taking a warm bath, massaging the legs, applying hot or cold packs to the legs, and possibly wearing a small device, marketed as Nidra, on each leg to stimulate the muscles and fool the body into thinking you're standing up. If you're at work, consider using a standing desk. If you're still taking dopamine agonists, Dr. Winkelman suggests asking your doctor why and perhaps bringing this article to your next appointment. Since you can't bring the article, maybe you can bring this tape. My concern is that most doctors aren't aware of the recommendation change, he says. But they're playing with fire when they prescribe dopamine medications for RLS. They need to think twice about prescribing them and caution patients about potential long-term complications. Here's a very practical article that applies to all of us, and it talks about four ways your teeth and gums are changing. What's happening inside your mouth? Maybe it seems like your gums are receding a bit or your teeth are shifting. In some cases, these kinds of developments can be age-related and nothing to worry about. In others, they may signal an underlying condition that needs attention. Consider the following changes and how to take action to address them. Receding gums. Does it look like your teeth are getting longer? They're not growing. Your gums are moving away from your teeth or receding. That can happen if you brush your teeth aggressively. If you brush too hard, it irritates the gums, and they move away from the source of irritation, says Dr. Lisa Thompson, a geriatric dentistry specialist at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine. Receding gums can also signal gum disease. That's caused by plaque buildup on teeth and leads to gum irritation, swelling, and bleeding. This early stage of disease, called gingivitis, can progress below the gum line, becoming periodontal disease, and destroy the ligament and bone holding the tooth in place. At that point, you can experience gum pain, abscesses, which are infected pockets of pus, and tooth loss. Here's how to take action. Go easy when you brush. Toothbrushing should be a gentle massage, not a vigorous scrub. Also, make sure you brush and floss at least twice a day and seek dental care on a regular basis. Gingivitis can be reversed, and once we get periodontal disease under control, we can stop it from worsening, as long as you maintain good dental hygiene and also go to your dentist's office regularly for deep cleanings, Dr. Thompson says. If you've lost teeth from gum disease, you may need surgery, bone grafts, tooth implants, or fixed or removable bridge. Number two is shifting teeth. It's hard to tell by simply looking at your smile, but your teeth shift slightly throughout life. After all, we put teeth through a great deal of stress as they smash and grind up food when we eat. The pressure of your tongue pushing against your teeth also contributes to subtle shifting, Dr. Thompson says. In some cases, this migration can make a difference in your bite or speech. More significant tooth shifting, the kind that changes your appearance, is caused by gum disease or bone loss. What you can do to take action? Talk to your dentist. For minor shifting, you may be a candidate for braces, which place pressure on the teeth to change their position. Don't worry. Braces are much more advanced and don't hurt as much as they did years ago. You might not need the kind that are glued to teeth. Plastic aligners might do the job. For significant shifting, you'll need to get underlying problems, such as gum disease, treated first, before considering braces. What about changing tooth color? The gleaming white outer layer or enamel of your teeth changes over time. It can turn gray or yellow from smoking or consuming foods or drinks that stain teeth, such as coffee or tea. Enamel can also become slightly translucent from a change in its water content or from tooth grinding, which wears down enamel. You can take action to whiten teeth by using bleaching trays. The kind you get at the dentist's office, fitted plastic retainers with whitening chemicals, are most effective. You might also consider getting veneers, which are porcelain covers for the surfaces of individual teeth. If you suspect that you grind your teeth at night, see your dentist, who will be able to detect telltale signs. If you do, wear a mouth guard at night to protect your teeth from future damage while you sleep, Dr. Thompson says. A custom fit device from the dentist's office will be stronger and more comfortable than the over-the-counter versions. And 4, tooth pain. Are your teeth less sensitive than they used to be? That's a nice development if you're drinking something cold or you need a dental procedure, but less sensitivity also has risks. Reduced dental pain is caused by the thickening of dentin, the porous yellow material beneath tooth enamel. Dentin buildup occurs with age. As dentin thickens, nerves inside the teeth shrink. You feel less pain, but you might also miss the warning signs of a cavity or another problem that's brewing. And it can go on so long that it gets to an advanced stage, Dr. Thompson says. Keep up daily brushing and flossing and get teeth cleanings at least twice a year. Like all health conditions, dental problems are easier to treat when they're caught early. Now briefly, can dark chocolate help you avoid diabetes? As if we need another reason to love chocolate, a Harvard study suggests that eating the sweet treat is tied to lower risks of diabetes. But the particular type of chocolate matters, according to the findings published December 7th in the British Medical Journal. Scientists evaluated the self-reported dietary and health information of about 112,000 healthy middle-aged people who were followed for more than 30 years. Compared with people who rarely or never ate chocolate, those who had at least 5 ounces of dark chocolate each week had a 21% lower risk of developing diabetes. There are no significant diabetes risk reductions among people who ate milk chocolate. In fact, that treat was tied to weight gain, which can eventually boost diabetes risk. What's the magic of dark chocolate? Even though it has about the same amount of saturated fat and calories as milk chocolate, dark chocolate is lower in sugar and much higher in flavanols. It's nice to end on a happy note, but we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I am Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After its broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast on our website, www.NorthCarolinaReadingService.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. So long. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832. ¶¶